that you?
Vinny's eyes opened wide.
Candy?
A naked woman somewhere in age between 20 and 50 bounced out of the bedroom. She had gigantic breasts, and her pubic hair cut into the shape of a thunderbolt. She held her arms out to Vinny.
Long time no see,
she said.
What's up?
A second woman straggled from the bedroom.
Is it really Vinny?
She asked.
What's he doing here?
I eased into the bedroom behind the women and looked for Bender. The bedroom was set with lights and a discarded camera. They hadn't been watching a porno. They'd been making one. Bender isn't in the bedroom or bathroom, I said to Vinny, and that's the whole house.
You looking for Andy?
Candy asked.
He split earlier. He said he had work to do. That's why we borrowed his place. Nice and private. At least until you showed up.
We thought we was getting busted,
the other woman said.
We thought you was the cops.
Clown gave each of the women his card.
Albert Clown, attorney at law, he said. If you ever need a lawyer.
An hour later, I pulled into my lot with Clown yammering away alongside me. I had Godsmack plugged into my CD player, but I couldn't get the volume loud enough to totally drown out Clown.
Boy, that was something, Clown said. I've never seen a movie star up close before, and especially naked ones. I didn't look too much, did I? I mean, you couldn't help looking, right? Even you looked, right?
Right. But I didn't get down on my knees to examine the pubic hair thunderbolt. I parked and walked Clown to his car, making sure he got safely out of the lot. I turned to go into the building and let out a yelp when I bumped into Ranger. He was standing close, and he was smiling.
Big date?
It's been a strange day.
How strange?
I told him about Vinny in the porno movie. Ranger tipped his head back and laughed out loud. Not something I see very often. Is this a social visit? I asked.
As social as I get. I'm on my way home from a job.
Home to the Batcave. No one knew where Ranger lived. The address on his driver's license was a vacant lot.
Yeah, the Batcave,
Ranger said. I'd like to see the Batcave sometime. Our eyes held.
Maybe someday,
he said.
Looks like you could use some body work on your car.
I told him about the spiders and about Abruzzi suggesting to me that at some point in time he'd rip my heart out.
Let me get this straight, Ranger said. You were driving along after being attacked by a flock of geese, and a spider jumped at you and caused you to smash into a parked car?
Stop smiling, I said. It isn't funny. I hate spiders. He slung an arm around my shoulders.
I know you do, babe. And you're worried Abruzzi will make good on his threat.
Yes.
You have too many dangerous men in your life.
I looked at him sideways. Do you have any suggestions on how I can cut the list down?
You could kill Abruzzi.
I raised my eyebrows.
No one would mind, Ranger said. He's not a popular guy.
And the other dangerous men in my life?
Not life-threatening. You might get your heart broken, but you won't get it ripped out of your body.
Oh boy, that's supposed to make me feel relaxed? Aside from your suggestion of killing Abruzzi, I don't know how to get him to stop, I said to Ranger. Soder might want his daughter back, but Abruzzi is after something else. And whatever it is that Abruzzi is after, he thinks I'm after it too. I looked up at my window. I wasn't real crazy about entering my apartment alone. The heart-ripping out thing still had me feeling spooked. and every now and then I felt non-existent spiders crawling on me. "So," I said, "as long as you're here, I don't suppose you'd want to come up and have a glass of wine?"
"Are you inviting me for more than wine?"
"Sort of."
"Let me take a guess. You want me to make sure your apartment is secure?"
"Yes." He beeped his car locked, and when we got to the second floor, he took my key and he opened my apartment door. He flipped the lights on and looked around. Rex was running on his wheel.
"Maybe you should teach him to bark," Ranger said.
He prowled through my living room, into my bedroom. He flipped the light on and looked around. He raised the dust ruffle and looked under the bed.
"You need to get a mop under there, babe," he said.
He moved to the dresser and opened each drawer. Nothing jumped out. He stuck his head into the bathroom. All clear.
"No snakes, no spiders, no bad guys," Ranger said.
He reached out, grasped the collar on my denim jacket with both hands, and pulled me to him, his fingers lightly brushing my neck.
"You're running up a bill. I assume you'll tell me when you're ready to settle your account."
"Sure. Absolutely. You'll be the first to know." God, I was being such a dork. Ranger grinned down at me.
"You have cuffs, right?"
"Ook."
"Actually, no. I'm currently cuffless."
"How are you going to catch the bad guys if you haven't got cuffs?"
"It's a problem."
"I have cuffs,"
Ranger said, touching his knee to mine. My heart was up to about 200 beats per minute. I wasn't exactly a handcuff-me-to-the-bed kind of person. I was more a turn-out-all-the-lights-and-hope-for-the-best kind of person. "I think I'm hyperventilating," I said. "If I pass out, just hold a paper bag over my nose and mouth."
"Babe," Ranger said, "it's not the end of the world to sleep with me."
"There are issues." He raised an eyebrow.
"Issues?"
"Well, actually, relationships."
"Are you in a relationship?"
Ranger asked. "No. Are you?"
"My lifestyle doesn't lend itself to relationships."
"Do you know what we need? Wine." He released my jacket collar and followed me into the kitchen. He lounged against the counter while I took two wine glasses from the cupboard and grabbed the bottle of Merlot that I'd just bought. I poured out two glasses, gave one to Ranger, and kept one for myself. "Cheers," I said, and I chugged the wine. Ranger took a sip.
"Feel better?"
"I'm getting there. I hardly feel like fainting anymore, and most of the nausea is gone." I refilled my glass and carted the bottle into the living room. "So," I said, "would you like to watch television?" He picked the remote off the coffee table and relaxed into the couch.
"Let me know when you're nausea-free."
"I think it was the handcuff thing that pushed me over the edge."
"I'm disappointed. I thought it was the idea of me naked."
He searched through the sports and settled on basketball.
"Are you okay with basketball? Or would you rather I search for a violent movie?"
"Basketball is good." "Okay. I know I was the one who suggested television, but now that I had Ranger on my couch, it felt too weird." He had his dark hair slicked back into a ponytail. He was dressed in SWAT blacks, fully loaded gun belt removed, but a 9mm at the small of his back, Navy SEAL watch on his wrist, and he was slouched on my couch, watching basketball. I noticed my wine glass was empty, and I poured myself a third glass. "This feels odd," I said. "Do you watch basketball in the Batcave?"
"I don't have a lot of free time for television."
"But the Batcave has a television?"
"Yeah, the Batcave has a television."
"Just curious," I said. He drank some wine, and he watched me. He was different from Morelli. Morelli was a tightly coiled spring. I was always aware of contained energy with Morelli. Ranger was a cat. Quiet. Every muscle relaxed on command. Probably did yoga. Might not be human.
Now what are you thinking?
He asked. I was wondering if you were human.
What are the other choices?
I knocked back my glass of wine. I didn't have anything else specifically in mind. I woke up with a headache, and my tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth. I was on my couch, tucked under the quilt from my bed. The television was silent, and Ranger was gone. From what I could remember, I'd seen about 5 minutes of basketball before falling asleep. I'm a cheap drunk. 2.5 glasses of wine, and I'm comatose. I stood under a hot shower until I was pruny and the throbbing behind my eyes had partially subsided. I got dressed and made tracks to McDonald's. I got a large fries and a Coke at the drive-thru and ate in the parking lot. This is the Stephanie Plum cure for a hangover. My cell phone rang when I was halfway through with the fries.
"Did you hear about the fire?" Grandma asked. "Do you know anything about it?"
"What fire?"
"Steven Soder's bar burned to the ground last night. Technically, I guess it burned this morning, since it was after closing when it caught fire. Lorraine Zupek just called. Her grandson is a firefighter, you know. He told her they had every truck in the city there, but there wasn't anything they could do. I guess they're thinking it might have been arson."
"Was anyone hurt?"
"Lorraine didn't say."
I shoved a handful of fries into my mouth and cranked the engine over. I wanted to see the fire scene. I'm not sure why. Ghoulish curiosity, I guess. If Soder had partners, then this wasn't entirely unexpected. Partners were known to come into a business sometimes, drain it of all profits, and then destroy it. It took me 20 minutes to get through town. The street in front of the foxhole was closed to traffic, so I parked 2 blocks away and walked. A fire truck was still on the scene, and a couple cop cars were angled into the curb. A photographer from the Trenton Times was taking pictures. Crime scene tape hadn't been stretched, but sightseers were kept at a distance by the police. The brick face was blackened. Windows were gone. There were 2 levels of apartments above the bar. They looked totally destroyed. Sooty water pooled on the street and sidewalk. A hose snaked into the building from the one remaining truck, but it wasn't in use. "Was anyone hurt?" I asked one of the bystanders.
"Doesn't look like it," he said. "It was after hours for the bar, and the apartments were empty. There were some code violations, so they were being renovated."
"Do they know how the fire got started?"
"Nobody said."
I didn't recognize any of the cops or firefighters. I didn't see Soder anywhere. I took one last look, and I left. A quick stop at the office was next on my list. Connie should have the more complete background check on Evelyn by now.
"Geez," Lula said when I walked in, "you don't look so good."
"Hangover," I said. "I ran into Ranger after I dropped Clown off, and we had a couple glasses of wine." Connie and Lula stopped what they were doing and stared at me.
"Well,"
Lula said,
"you're not going to stop there, are you? What happened?"
"Nothing happened. I was sort of creeped out about the spiders and stuff, so Ranger came in with me to make sure everything was okay. We had a couple glasses of wine, and he left."
"Yeah, but what about the part between the drinking and the leaving? What happened there?"
"Nothing happened."
"Hold on here," Lula said. "You're telling me you had Ranger in your apartment, the two of you are drinking wine, and nothing happened? No fooling around at all?"
"That makes no sense," Connie said. "Anytime the two of you are in this office, he's looking at you like you're lunch. There has to be some explanation. Your grandma was there, right?"
"It was just the two of us, just Ranger and me."
"Did you put him off? You smack him or something?" Lula asked.
"It wasn't like that. It was friendly, in an uncomfortably tense sort of way."
"Friendly?"
Lula said.
"Huh."
"So, how do you feel about that?"
Connie asked me. "I don't know," I said. "I guess friendly is good."
"Yeah, except naked and sweaty would be better,"
Lula said. We all thought about that for a moment. Connie fanned herself with a steno pad.
"Whew," she said. Hot flesh.
I resisted looking down to see if my nipples were hard. Did Evelyn's report come in? Connie leafed through a stack of folders on her desk and pulled one out.
Just got it this morning.
I took the folder and read down the first page. I turned to the second page.
Not a lot there, Connie said. Evelyn stuck pretty close to home, even as a kid.
I stuffed the folder into my bag and looked up at the video camera. Is Vinny here?
He hasn't come in yet. Probably got candy inflating his ego,
Lula said. Chapter 9. I read through Evelyn's file one more time when I got to my car. Some of the information seemed invasive, but this is the age of data for anyone interested. I had a credit report and some medical history. Nothing struck me as incredibly helpful. A rap on my passenger side window pulled me away from the file. It was Morelli. I unlocked the door, and he slid in next to me.
Hungover?
He asked, but it was more of a statement than a question. How'd you know? He poked at the fast food carton.
McDonald's French fries and Coke for breakfast. Dark circles under your eyes. Hair from hell.
I checked out my hair in the rearview mirror. Yow. I overdid the wine last night. He took that in. Nothing was said for a long moment. I didn't volunteer more.
He didn't ask.
He looked at the file in my hand.
Are you getting any closer to Evelyn?
I've made some progress.
You heard about Soder's bar.
I just came from there, I said. It looked bad. Lucky no one was in the building.
Yeah, except so far we haven't been able to locate Soder. His girlfriend said he never came home.
Do you think he could have been in the bar when the fire broke out?
The guys are in there checking. They had to wait for the building to cool. No sign of him so far. I thought you'd want to know.
Morelli had his hand on the door handle.
I'll let you know if we find him.
Wait a minute. I have a theoretical question. Suppose you were watching television with me, and we were alone in my apartment, and I had a couple of glasses of wine, and I sort of passed out. Would you try to make love to me anyway? Would you do a little exploring while I was asleep?
What are we watching? Is it the playoffs?
You can leave now, I said. Morelli grinned and got out of the car. I dialed Dottie's number on my cell phone. I was anxious to tell her the news about the bar and about Soder going missing. The phone rang a bunch of times and the machine picked it up. I left a message for a callback and tried her work number. I got her voicemail at work. Dottie was on vacation, scheduled to return in 2 weeks. The voicemail message sent a strange emotion curling through my stomach. I searched for a name for the emotion. Unease was the closest I could come. In less than an hour, I was parked in front of Dottie's house. No sign of Jean Ellen, and no sign of life in Dottie's house. No car in the driveway, no doors or windows opened. Nothing wrong with that, I told myself. The kids would be in school and daycare at this time of day, and Dottie was probably out shopping. I walked to the door and rang the bell. No one answered. I looked in the front window. The house looked at rest. No lights on, no television blaring, no kids running around. The bad feeling crept into my stomach again. Something was wrong. I walked around and looked in the back window. The kitchen was tidy. No signs of breakfast, no bowls in the sink, no cereal boxes left out. I tried the doorknob. Locked. I knocked on the door. No response. That's when it hit me. No dog. The dog should be running around, barking at the door. It was a one-story ranch. I circled the house and looked in every window. No dog. Okay, so she's walking the dog. Or maybe she took the dog to the vet. I tried Dottie's two closest neighbors. Neither knew what had happened to Dottie and the dog. Both had noticed they were missing this morning. The consensus was that Dottie and her family vacated the house sometime during the night. No Dottie, no dog, No Jean Allen. I had other names for the thing in my stomach now. Panic. Fear. With a touch of nausea from the hangover. I went back to my car and sat in front of the house for a while, taking it all in. At some point, I looked down at my watch and realized an hour had passed. I suppose I was hoping Dottie would return, and I suppose I knew it wasn't going to happen. When I was 9 years old, I persuaded my mom to let me get a parakeet. On the way home from the pet store, the door to the cage came open somehow, and the bird flew away. That's what this felt like. It felt like I left the door open. I put the car in gear and drove back to the burg. I went straight to Dottie's parents' house. Mrs. Pawlowski answered my knock, and Dottie's dog came running from the kitchen, yapping the whole way. I dredged up my biggest and best phony smile for Mrs. Pawlowski. "Hi," I said. "I'm looking for Dottie."
"You just missed her," Mrs. Pawlowski said. "She dropped Scotty off early this morning. We're babysitting him while Dottie and the children are on vacation."
"I really need to talk to her," I said. "Do you have a phone number where she can be reached?"
"I don't. She said she was going camping with a friend. A cabin in the woods somewhere. She said she'd be in touch, though. I could give her a message."
I gave Mrs. Pawlowski my card. "Tell Dottie I have very important information for her, and ask her to call me."
"Dottie isn't in any kind of trouble, is she?"
Mrs. Pawlowski asked. "No, this is information about one of Dottie's friends."
"It's Evelyn, isn't it? I heard Evelyn and Annie were missing. That's such a shame. Evelyn and Dottie used to be such good friends."
"Do they still get together?"
"Not for years now. Evelyn kept to herself after she married. I think Stephen made it difficult for her to have friends."
I thanked Mrs. Pawlowski for her time and returned to my car. I reread the report on Evelyn. No mention of a secret cabin in the woods. My phone chirped, and I wasn't sure what I hoped for. A date was high on the list. Next might be news about Soder or a friendly call from Evelyn. Close to last on the list was a call from my mother.
"Help," she said.
Then my grandmother got on the phone.
"You gotta come over and see this," she said.
"See what?"
"You gotta see for yourself."
My parents' house was less than 5 minutes away. My mother and grandmother were at the door waiting for me. They stepped aside and motioned me into the living room. My sister was there, slouched in my father's favorite chair. She was dressed in a rumpled long flannel nightgown and furry bedroom slippers. Yesterday's mascara hadn't been removed, but had been smudged by sleep. Her hair was snarled and untamed. Meg Ryan meets Beetlejuice. California girl goes to Transylvania. She had the television remote in her hand, her attention glued to a game show. The floor around her was littered with candy bar wrappers and empty soda cans. She didn't acknowledge our presence. She burped and scratched her boob and changed the channel. This was my perfect sister, Saint Valerie.
"I see that smile," my mother said to me. "It's not funny. She's been like that ever since she lost her job."
"Yeah, we had to vacuum around her this morning," Grandma said. "I came too close and almost sucked up one of those bunny slippers."
"She's depressed," my mother said.
"No shit."
"We thought maybe you could help her get a job," Grandma said. "Something that would get her out of the house, on account of now we're getting depressed looking at her. Bad enough we got to look at your father."
"You're always the one with the jobs," I said to my mother. "You always know when they're hiring at the button factory."
"She ran through all my contacts," my mother said. "I'm left with nothing. And unemployment is up. I can't get her a job boxing tampons."
"Maybe you could take her along with you on a bust," Grandma said. "Maybe that'd perk her spirits up."
"No way," I said. "She already tried being a bounty hunter, and she fainted the first time someone held a gun to her head." My mother made the sign of the cross.
"Dear God," she said.
"Well, you gotta do something," Grandma said. "I'm missing all my TV shows. I tried to change the channel. and she growled at me.
She growled at you?
It was scary.
Hey, Valerie, I said, is there a problem? No response.
I got an idea, Grandma said. Why don't we give her a zap with your stun gun? Then when she's out cold, we can get the remote.
I thought about the stun gun in my bag. I wouldn't mind testing it. I wouldn't even mind zapping Valerie. Truth is, I've secretly wanted to zap Valerie for years. I slid a look at my mother and was instantly discouraged. Maybe I can get you a job, I said to Valerie. Would you be willing to work for a lawyer? She kept focused on the television.
Is he married?
No.
Gay?
I don't think so.
How old is he?
I'm not sure. 16, maybe. I hauled my cell phone out of my bag and called Clown.
Wow, that would be great if your sister would work for me, Clown said. She could have all the time she wants for lunch, and she could do her laundry while she works.
I severed the connection and turned to Valerie. You have a job.
Bummer,
Valerie said.
I was just starting to get the hang of this depression thing. Do you think this guy will marry me?
I did some internal eye-rolling, wrote Clown's name and address on a piece of paper, and gave it to Valerie. You can start tomorrow at 9. If he's late, you can wait for him in the laundromat. You won't have any trouble recognizing him. He's the guy with the two black eyes. My mother did another sign of the cross. I swiped a couple slices of bologna and a slice of cheese from the fridge and headed for the door. I wanted to get out of the house before I had to answer any more questions about Albert Clown. The phone rang as I was leaving.
Hold up, Grandma said to me. This here's Florence Suck, and she says she's at the mall, and she says Evelyn Soder is eating lunch in the food court.
I took off running, and Grandma was right behind me.
I'm going too, Grandma said. I got a ride on account of how it was my snitch that called.
We jumped into the car, and I rocketed away. The mall was 20 minutes on a good day. I hoped Evelyn was a slow eater.
Was she sure it was Evelyn?
Yep. Evelyn and Annie, and another woman and her two children.
Dottie and her kids.
I didn't have time to get my purse, Grandma said, so I haven't got a gun. I'm going to be real disappointed if they're shooting and I'm the only one without a gun.
If my mother knew my grandmother was carrying a gun around in her purse, she'd have a cow. First off, I haven't got a gun, I said, and second thing, there won't be any shooting. I hit Route 1 and put my foot to the floor. This brought me into the flow of traffic. In Jersey, we think the speed limit is merely a suggestion. No one in Jersey would actually do the speed limit.
You should be a race car driver, Grandma said. You'd be good at it. You could drive in them NASCAR races. I'd do it, but probably you need a driver's license, and I don't have one of those.
I saw the sign for the shopping center and took the off-ramp with my fingers crossed. What had started as a courtesy to Mabel had become a crusade. I really wanted to talk to Evelyn. Evelyn was critical to ending the crazy war game, and ending the war game was critical to not getting my heart ripped out. I knew every square inch of the mall, and I parked at the entrance to the food court. I wanted to tell Grandma to wait in the car, but that would have been wasted energy. If Evelyn is still there, I need to talk to her alone, I said to Grandma. You're going to have to stay out of sight.
Sure, Grandma said. I can do that.
We entered the mall together and quickly walked to the food court. I watched the people while I walked, looking for Evelyn or Dottie. The mall was moderately full, not jammed like on weekends, just enough people to give me cover. My breath caught when I recognized Dottie and her kids. I'd memorized the photo of Evelyn and Annie, and they were there, too.
Now that I'm here, I wouldn't mind having a big pretzel, Grandma said.
You get a pretzel, and I'll talk to Evelyn. Just don't leave the food court. I stepped away from Grandma, and the light suddenly dimmed in front of me. I was in the shadow of Martin Paulson. He didn't look much different than he had in the police station parking lot, rolling around on the ground, trussed up in shackles and handcuffs, I imagine fashion choices are limited when you're shaped like Paulson.
Well, looky here, Paulson said. It's Little Miss Asshole.
Not now, I said, moving around him. He moved with me, blocking my way.
I have a score to settle with you.
What are the chances? I finally find Evelyn, and I run into Martin Paulson, itching for a fight. Forget it, I said. What are you doing here, anyway?
I work here. I work at the drugstore, and I'm on my lunch break. I was falsely accused, you know.
Yeah, right. Get out of my way.
Make me.
I pulled the stun gun out of my bag, rammed it into Paulson's big belly, and hit the button. Nothing happened. Paulson looked down at the stun gun.
What is that, a toy?
It's a stun gun. A worthless piece of crap stun gun. Paulson took it from me and looked at it.
Cool,
he said. He turned it off, and then he turned it on. And then he touched it to my arm. There was a flash of light in my head, and everything went black. Before the blackness turned back to light, I could hear voices far away. I struggled to get to the voices, and they became louder, more distinct. I managed to get my eyes open, and faces swam into view. I tried to blink away the buzzing, and I took an assessment of the situation. Flat on my back, on the floor. Paramedics hovering over me. Oxygen mask over my nose. Blood pressure cuff on my arm. Grandma beyond the paramedics looking worried. Paulson beyond Grandma peeking at me over her shoulder. Paulson. Now I remember, the son of a bitch knocked me out with my own stun gun. I jumped up and lunged at Paulson. My legs gave out, and I went down to my knees. Paulson, you pig! I yelled. Paulson ducked back and disappeared. I was trying to get the oxygen mask off, and the paramedics were trying to keep it on. It was the attack of the geese all over again.
I thought you were dead,
Grandma said. Not nearly. I accidentally came into contact with my stun gun when it was live.
Now I recognize you, one of the paramedics said to me. You're the bounty hunter who burned a funeral home down. I burned it down, too, Grandma said. You should have been there. It was like fireworks.
I stood and tested my ability to walk. I was a little creaky, but I didn't fall down. That was a good sign, right? Grandma handed me my shoulder bag.
That nice round man gave me your stun gun. I guess it got dropped in all the excitement. I put it in your bag, she said.
First chance I got, I was going to pitch the damn stun gun into the Delaware River. I looked around, but Evelyn was long gone. I don't suppose you saw Evelyn or Annie, I asked Grandma.
No, I got myself one of those big soft pretzels, and I had them dip it in chocolate.
I dropped Grandma off at my parents' house, and I went home to my apartment. I stood in the hall at the door for a moment before inserting the key in the lock. I took a deep breath, unlocked the door, and pushed it open. I stepped into the small foyer area, and I very softly sang, "Who's afraid of the big bad wolf?" I peeked into my kitchen and felt a sense of relief. Everything was okay in the kitchen. I moved into the living room and stopped singing. Stephen Soder was sitting on my couch. He was listening slightly to one side, holding the remote in his right hand, but he wasn't watching television. He was dead, dead, dead. His eyes were milky and unseeing. His lips were parted, as if he'd been surprised. His skin was ghoulishly bloodless, and he had a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead. He was wearing a baggy sweater and khaki slacks, and he was barefoot. Criminy, isn't it bad enough I have a dead guy sitting on my couch? Does he have to be freaking barefoot? I silently backed out of the room and out of my apartment. I stood in the hall and tried to dial 911 on my cell phone, but my hands were shaking and I had to try several times before I got it right.
I stayed in the hall until the police arrived. When my apartment was swarming with cops, I crept back into my kitchen, wrapped my arms around Rex's cage, and took Rex out of the apartment into the hall with me. I was still in the hall holding the hamster cage when Morelli arrived. Mrs. Carwatt from next door and Irma Brown from upstairs were with me. Beyond Mr. Walesky's door, I could hear Regis. Not even for a homicide would Mr. Walesky miss Regis, no matter it was a rerun. I was sitting on the floor, back to the wall, hamster cage on my lap. Morelli squatted next to me and looked in at Rex.
Is he okay?
I nodded yes.
How about you?
Morelli asked.
Are you okay?
My eyes filled with tears.
I wasn't okay.
He was sitting on the couch,
Irma said to Morelli.
Can you imagine just sitting there with the remote in his hand?
She shook her head.
That couch has death cooties now. I'd cry too if my couch had death cooties. There's no such thing as death cooties,
Mrs. Carwatt said. Irma looked over at her.
Would you sit on that couch now?
Mrs. Carwatt pressed her lips together.
Well?
Irma asked.
Maybe if it was washed real good. You can't wash away death cooties,
Irma said. End of discussion. Voice of authority. Morelli sat next to me, his back to the wall, too. Mrs. Carwatt left, and Irma left, and it was just Morelli and me and Rex.
So what do you think about death cooties?
Morelli asked me. I don't know what the hell death cooties are, but I'm creeped out enough to want to get rid of the couch, and I'm going to boil the remote and dip it in bleach.
This is bad, Morelli said. This isn't fun and games anymore. Did Mrs. Carwatt hear or see anything unusual?
I shook my head, no. Home is supposed to be the safe place, I said to Morelli. Where do you go when your home doesn't feel safe anymore?
I don't know,
Morelli said.
I've never had to face that.
It was hours before the body was removed and the apartment was sealed.
Now what?
Morelli asked.
You can't stay here tonight.
Our eyes locked, and we were both thinking the same thing. A couple months ago, Morelli wouldn't have asked that question. I would have stayed with Morelli. Things were different now. I'll stay with my parents, I said, just overnight until I figure things out. Morelli went in and grabbed some clothes for me and shoved the essentials in a gym bag. He loaded Rex and me into his truck and drove us to the Berg. Valerie and the kids were sleeping in my old bedroom, so I slept on the couch with Rex on the floor beside me. I have friends who take Xanax to help them sleep. I take macaroni and cheese, and if my mom is making it for me, so much the better. I had macaroni and cheese at 11 o'clock and fell into a fitful sleep. I had more macaroni at 2 and more at 4:30. A microwave is a wonderful invention. At 7:30, I woke up to a lot of yelling going on upstairs. My father was causing the usual morning bottleneck in the bathroom.
I have to brush my teeth,
Angie said.
I'm going to be late for school.
What about me?
Grandma wanted to know.
I'm old. I can't hold it forever.
She hammered on the bathroom door.
What are you doing in there anyway?
Mary Alice was making snorting horse sounds, galloping in place and pawing the floor.
Stop that galloping, Grandma shouted to Mary Alice. You're giving me a headache. Go downstairs to the kitchen and get some pancakes.
Hay,
Mary Alice said.
Horses eat hay, and I already ate. I have to brush my teeth. It's real bad when horses get cavities.
The toilet flushed and the bathroom door opened. There was a brief scuffle, and the door slammed shut. Valerie and the two girls groaned. Grandma beat them to the bathroom. An hour later, my father was out to work. The girls were off to school, and Valerie was in a state.
Is this too flirty?
She asked, standing in front of me in a gauzy little flower dress and strappy heels.
Would a suit be better?
I was scanning the paper, looking for mention of soda.
It doesn't matter, I said. Where would you want?
I need help,
Valerie said, arms flapping.
I can't make these decisions all by myself. And what about the shoes? Should I wear these pink heels, or should I wear the retro Weitzmans?
I found a dead man sitting on my couch last night. I have couch cooties, and Valerie needs me to make a shoe decision. Wear the pink things, I said, and take extra quarters if you have any. Clown can always use extra quarters. The phone rang, and Grandma ran to answer it. The calls would start now, and would go on all day. The Berg loved a good murder. I have a daughter who finds men dead on her couch, my mother said. Why me? Lois Seltzman's daughter never finds dead men on her couch.
Isn't this something? Grandma said. 3 calls already and it's not even 9. This could be bigger than the time your car got crushed by the garbage truck.
I had Valerie drive me to my apartment building on her way to work. I needed my car, and my car was parked in the lot. Upstairs, my apartment was sealed. Fine by me. I was in no great rush to move back in. I got into the CRV and sat there a moment, listening to the quiet. Quiet was in short supply at my parents' house. Mr. Kleinschmidt passed me on the way to his car.
Nice going, Chickie, he said. We can always count on you to keep things interesting. Did you really find a dead guy on your couch?
I nodded. Yes.
Boy, that must have been something. I wish I could have seen him.
Mr. Kleinschmidt's enthusiasm dragged a smile out of me. Maybe next time.
Yeah,
Mr. Kleinschmidt said happily.
Call me first thing next time.
He gave me a wave and went off to his car. Okay, so here we have a new point of view when it comes to dead people. Dead people can be fun. I thought about it for a couple minutes, but had a hard time buying into the concept. The best I could do was an admission that Soder's death made my job easier. Evelyn had no reason to flee with Annie now that Soder was out of the picture. Mabel could stay in her house. Annie could return to school. Evelyn could get her life together. Unless Eddie Abruzzi was part of the reason Evelyn had to hide. If Evelyn left because she had something Abruzzi wanted, nothing would change. I looked at the blue and white and the crime scene truck in my parking lot. The bright spot in all this was that unlike snakes in the hall and spiders in my car, this was a major crime, and the police would work hard to solve it. And how hard could it be to solve? Someone had dragged a dead man into the foyer, up a flight of stairs, down the hall, and into my apartment during daylight hours. I dialed Morelli on my cell phone. I have some questions, I said. How did they get Soder into my apartment?
You don't want to know.
I do.
I'll meet you for coffee, Morelli said. There's a new coffee shop across from the hospital.
I got a coffee and a croissant, and I sat across from Morelli. Tell me, I said.
Soder was sawed in half.
What?
Someone used a power saw to cut Soder in half, and then they reassembled him on your couch. The baggy sweater was hiding the fact that they duct-taped Soder back together.
My lips went numb, and I could feel the coffee cup sliding from my grasp. Morelli reached forward and pushed my head down between my legs.
Breathe,
he said. The bells stopped clanging in my brain, and the dots went away. I sat up and took a sip of coffee. I'm better now, I said. Morelli did a sigh.
If only I could believe that.
All right, so they cut him in half. Then what?
We think they used a couple big duffel bags to bring him in. Hockey bags, maybe. Now that you've gotten over the gruesome part, the rest of the story is actually ingenious.
Two guys dressed in costume, carrying duffel bags and balloons, were seen entering the lobby and using the elevator. There were two tenants in the lobby at the time. They said they assumed someone was getting one of those singing birthday presents. Mr. Kleinschmidt had turned 80 the week before, and someone sent him two strippers.
What sort of costume were these guys wearing?
One was a bear, and the other was a rabbit. No faces showing. About 6 foot tall, but hard to tell with the costume. We found the balloons in your closet. They took the bags back with them.
Did anyone see them leave?
No one in your building. We're still canvassing the neighborhood. We're checking on costume rentals, too. So far, we haven't come up with anything.
It was Abruzzi. He was the one who left the snakes and the spiders. He was the one who put the cardboard cutout on my fire escape.
Can you prove it?
No.
That's the problem,
Morelli said.
And probably Abruzzi didn't personally dirty his hands.
There's a connection between Abruzzi and Soder. Abruzzi was the partner who took over the bar, right?
Soder lost his bar to Abruzzi because of a card game. Soder was playing some high-stakes guys, and he needed money. He borrowed the money from Ziggy Zimmerli, and Zimmerli is owned by Abruzzi. Soder lost big time at the card game, couldn't repay the money he borrowed from Zimmerli, and Abruzzi took the bar.
So what's the deal with the bar burning down and Soder getting shot?
I'm not sure. Probably the bar and Soder moved from the asset column to the liability column and were liquidated.
Did you pick up any prints in my apartment?
None that didn't belong there, with the exception of Ranger.
I work with him.
Yeah, Morelli said. I know.
I'm assuming Evelyn isn't a suspect, I said.
Anyone can hire a rabbit and a bear to chop a guy up, Morelli said. We aren't ruling anyone out yet.
I picked at my croissant. Morelli had his cop face on, and it didn't give much away. Still, I had a feeling there was more. Is there something you're not telling me?
There was a detail we're not releasing to the press, Morelli said.
A gruesome detail?
Yeah.
Let me make a guess. Soder's heart was ripped out. Morelli looked at me for a couple beats.
This guy is about as crazy as they come, he finally said. I'd like to protect you, but I don't know how. I could chain you to my wrist, or I could lock you up in a closet in my house, or you could pack off for an extended vacation. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to agree to any of those things.
Actually, I thought all of those options sounded kind of appealing. But Morelli was right. I couldn't agree to any of them. Chapter 10. I took another sip of coffee and looked around the cafe. It had been nicely decorated with new black and white tile on the floor and round wrought iron soda fountain style tables and chairs. Morelli and I were the only ones there. It took the burg a while to warm up to new things. Thanks for being so nice to me last night, I said to Morelli. He slouched back in his seat.
Against my better judgment, I love you.
I paused with the coffee cup midway to my mouth, and my heart did a flip-flop.
Don't get all excited, Morelli said. That doesn't mean I want a relationship.
You could do worse, I said.
With who? Lizzie Borden?
You're not perfect either.
I don't find dead guys sitting on my couch.
Well, I don't have a knife scar slicing through my eyebrow from a barroom brawl.
That happened years ago.
So? The dead guy was on my couch yesterday. It's been 24 hours since anything bad has happened. Morelli pushed back from the table.
I have to get back to work. Try to stay out of trouble.
And he was gone, off to fight crime. I, on the other hand, had no crime to fight. Bender was my only open case, and I was willing to pretend he didn't exist. I was thinking about a second croissant when Les Sebring called on my cell phone.
"Could you stop by the office?" Sebring asked. "I'd like to talk to you."
I cut across town and got another call just as I was cruising the street in front of Sebring's office looking for parking.
"He's a nerd," Valerie said. "You didn't tell me he was a nerd."
Who?
Albert Clown. And what's with the hovering? Sometimes I can actually feel him breathing down my neck.
He's insecure.
Try thinking of him as a pet.
A golden retriever.
More like a giant hamster.
I was sort of hoping he'd marry me,
Valerie said.
I was hoping he'd be taller.
Valerie, this isn't a date. This is a job. Where is he now?
He went next door. There's something wrong with the vending machine that dispenses detergent.
He's a nice guy. A little annoying, maybe. But he won't fire you for spilling chicken soup. In fact, he'll buy you a replacement lunch. Think about it.
And I shouldn't have worn these shoes,
Valerie said.
I'm dressed all wrong.
I disconnected and found a place to park on the street across from Sebring. I put a quarter in the meter and made sure it registered. I didn't need another parking ticket. I still hadn't paid the last one. Sebring's secretary walked me upstairs and led me into Sebring's private office. Sebring was waiting for me, and so was Jean Ellen Burroughs. I extended my hand to Sebring. Nice to see you again, I said. I nodded to Jean Ellen. She smiled in return. I guess you're out of a job, I said to Jean Ellen.
Yes, and I'll be flying to Puerto Rico later today to pick up an FTA for Les. I wanted to tell you about Soder before I left. For what it's worth, Soder claimed Annie was in danger. He never articulated that danger, but he felt Evelyn was incapable of protecting his daughter. I wasn't successful at locating Annie, but I realized Dottie was the conduit, the weak link, so I guarded Dottie.
What about the back door? That was left unguarded.
I had the house wired, Jean Ellen said. I knew you were in there.
The house was wired, but you still couldn't find Evelyn?
Evelyn's location was never mentioned. You blew the whistle on me before I had a chance to follow Dottie to Evelyn.
And what about Soder? The scene in the bookstore and at Dottie's house?
Soder was a fool. He thought he could bully Dottie into talking.
Why are you telling me all this? Jean Ellen shrugged.
Professional courtesy.
I looked beyond her to Sebring. Do you have an ongoing interest in this?
Not unless Soder comes back from the dead.
What's your opinion? Do you think Annie's in danger?
Someone killed her father, Sebring said. That's not a good sign. Unless, of course, it was Annie's mom who hired the hit. Then everything works out roses.
Do either of you know how Eddie Abruzzi fits into this puzzle?
He owned Soder's bar, Jean Ellen said. And Soder was afraid of him. If Annie actually was in danger, I thought the threat might be tied to Abruzzi. Nothing concrete, just a feeling I had.
I hear you found Soder sitting on your couch, Sebring said to me. Do you know what that means?
My couch has death cooties.
Sebring smiled, and his teeth almost blinded me.
You can't wash away death cooties, he said. Once they're on your couch, they're there to stay.
I left the office on that cheery note. I got into my car, and I took a moment to process the new information. What did it mean? It didn't mean much. It reinforced my fear that Evelyn and Annie were running not just from Soder, but from Abruzzi as well. Valerie called again.
If I go out to lunch with Albert, would it be a date?
Only if he rips your clothes off. I hung up and put the car in gear. I was going back to the Berg, and I was going to talk to Dottie's mom. She was the only connection I had to Evelyn. If Dottie's mom said Dottie and Evelyn were peachy fine and coming home, I'd feel like I was off the hook. I'd go to the mall and get a manicure. Mrs. Pulaski opened her front door and gasped at seeing me on her porch.
Oh, dear,
she said, as if the death couch cooties were contagious. I sent her a reassuring smile and a little finger wave. Hi. I hope I'm not imposing.
Not at all, dear. I heard about Stephen Soder. I don't know what to think.
Me either, I said. I don't know why he was put on my couch. I did a grimace. Go figure. At least he wasn't killed there. They packed him in. Even as I said it, I knew it was lame. Leaving a sawed-in half-corpse on a girl's couch is rarely a random act. The thing is, Mrs. Pulaski, I really do need to talk to Dottie. I was hoping she might have heard about Soder and gotten in touch with you.
As a matter of fact, she did. She called this morning, and I told her you were asking after her.
Did she say when she'd be home?
She said she might be gone a while.
That was all she said.
There goes the manicure. Mrs. Pawlowski wrapped her arms tight around herself.
Evelyn dragged Dottie into this, didn't she? It's not like Dottie to take off from work and pull Amanda out of school to go on a camping trip. I think something bad is going on. I heard about Stephen Soder, and I went straight to Mass. I didn't pray for Soder either. He can go to hell for all I care.
She crossed herself.
I prayed for Dottie, she said.
Do you have any idea where Dottie might be? If she was trying to help Evelyn, where would she take her?
I don't know. I've tried to think, but I can't figure it out. I doubt Evelyn has much money, and Dottie is on a tight budget, so I can't see them flying off to some place. Dottie said she had to stop at the mall yesterday to get some last-minute camping things, so maybe she really is camping. Sometimes, before the divorce, Dottie and her husband would go to a campground by Washington's Crossing. I can't think of the name, but it was right on the river, and you could rent a little trailer.
I knew the campground. I'd passed it a million times on the way to New Hope. Okay, now I was cooking. I had a lead. I could check out the campground. Only thing, I didn't want to check it out alone. It was too isolated at this time of year, too easy for Abruzzi to ambush me. So I took a deep breath and called Ranger.
Yo,
Ranger said. I have a lead on Evelyn, and I could use some backup. 20 minutes later, I was parked in the Washington's Crossing parking lot, and Ranger pulled in beside me. He was driving a shiny black 4x4 pickup with oversized tires and bug lights on the cab. I locked my car and hoisted myself into his passenger seat. The interior of the truck looked like Ranger regularly communicated with Mars.
How's your mental health?
He asked.
I heard about Soder.
I'm rattled.
I have a cure. Oh, boy.
He put the truck in gear and headed for the exit.
I know what you're thinking, he said, and that wasn't where I was going. I was going to suggest work.
I knew that. He looked over at me and grinned.
You'll want me bad.
I did. God help me. We're going north, I said. There's a chance that Evelyn and Dottie are at the campground with the little trailers.
I know the campground.
The road was empty at this time of day. Two lanes winding along the Delaware River and through the Pennsylvania countryside. Patches of woods and clusters of pretty houses bordered the road. Ranger was silent while he drove. He was paged twice, and both times he read the message and didn't respond. Both times he kept the message to himself. Normal behavior for Ranger. Ranger led a secret life. The pager buzzed a third time. Ranger unclipped it from his belt and looked at the readout. He cleared the screen, reclipped the pager, and continued to watch the road. Hello, I said. He cut his eyes to me. Ranger and I were oil and water. He was the man of mystery, and I was Ms. Curiosity. We both knew this. Ranger tolerated it with mild amusement. I tolerated it with teeth clenched. I dropped my eyes to his pager. Jean Ellen? I asked. I couldn't help myself.
Jean Ellen is on her way to Puerto Rico, Ranger said.
Our eyes held for a moment, and he turned his attention back to the road. End of conversation. It's a good thing you have a nice ass, I said to him. Because you sure as hell can be annoying.
My ass isn't my best part, babe,
Ranger said, smiling at me. And that truly did end the conversation. I had no follow-up. 10 minutes later, we approached the campground. It sat between the road and the river and could easily go unnoticed. It didn't have a sign, and for all I knew, it didn't have a name. A dirt road slanted down to a couple acres of grass. Small ramshackle cabins and trailers were scattered along the river's edge, each with a picnic table and grill. It had an air of abandonment at this time of year, and it felt slightly disreputable and intriguing, like a gypsy encampment. Ranger idled at the entrance, and we scanned the surroundings.
No cars,
Ranger said. He eased the truck down the drive and parked.
He reached under the dash, removed a Glock, and we got out of the truck. We systematically went down the row of cabins and trailers, trying doors, looking in windows, checking the grills for recent use. The lock was broken on the front door to the fourth cabin. Ranger rapped once and opened the door. The front room had a small kitchen area at one end, not high-tech. Sink, stove, fridge, circa 1950. The floor was covered with scuffed linoleum. There was a full-size couch at the far end of the room, a square wood table, and four chairs. The only other room to the cabin was a bedroom with two sets of bunks. The bunks had mattresses, but no sheets or blankets. The bathroom was minuscule, a sink and a toilet, no shower or tub. The toothpaste in the sink looked fresh. Ranger picked a pink plastic little girl's barrette off the floor.
"They've moved on," he said.
We checked the refrigerator. It was empty. We went outside and investigated the remaining cabins and trailers. All the others were locked. We checked the dumpster and found a single small bag of garbage.
"Did you have any other leads?"
Ranger asked me. "No."
"Let's walk through their houses."
I picked my car up at Washington's Crossing and drove it across the river. I parked in front of my parents' house and got back into Ranger's truck. We went to Dottie's house first. Ranger parked in the driveway, removed the Glock from under the dash again, and we went to the front door. Ranger had his hand on the doorknob and his handy-dandy lockpicking tool in his hand. And the door swung open. No lockpicking necessary. It would appear we were coming in second in the breaking and entering race.
"Stay here,"
Ranger said. He stepped into the living room and did a quick survey. He walked through the rest of the house with his gun drawn. He returned to the living room and motioned me in. I closed and locked the door behind me. "Nobody home?"
"No. There are drawers pulled out and papers scattered on the kitchen counter. Either somebody's been through the house, or else Dottie left in a hurry."
"I was here after Dottie left. I didn't go into the house, but I looked in the windows, and the house seemed neat. Do you think the house could have been burgled?" I knew in my heart it wasn't burglary, but one can hope.
"Don't think the motive was burglary. There's a computer in the kid's room, and a diamond engagement ring in the jewelry box in the mother's room. The television is still here. My guess is, we're not the only ones looking for Evelyn and Annie."
"Maybe it was Jean Ellen. She had a bug planted here. Maybe she came back to get her bug before she left for Puerto Rico."
"Jean Ellen isn't sloppy. She wouldn't leave the front door open, and she wouldn't leave evidence of a break-in."
My voice inadvertently rose an octave.
"Maybe she was having a bad day. Cripes, doesn't she ever have a bad day?"
Ranger looked at me and smiled.
"Okay, so I'm getting a little tired of the perfect Jean Ellen," I said.
"Jean Ellen isn't perfect," Ranger said. "She's just very good."
He slung an arm around my shoulders and kissed me below my ear.
"Maybe we can find an area where your skills exceed Jean Ellen's."
I narrowed my eyes at him. "Did you have something in mind?"
"Nothing I'd want to get in.